How do I know that line you handed me on the phone's on the level? Your voice don't even sound the same.
Neither will yours when you put on a mask.
Who else figures in it besides me?
You ask too many questions.
And I'm not getting any answers. I'd like to know who I work with, when we make a split, and who I take my orders from.
Get out of here!
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and I can't help but think about that bit in the 2008 Batman movie when the Joker says,
"This town deserves a better class of criminal."
When we start thinking about elite online crime forums, just as we are today. Our guest for this episode, Dr. Benoit Dupont, has recently authored a paper on one such market titled "Countering Distrust in Illicit Online Networks: The Dispute Resolution Strategies of Cybercriminals," which you can find more details in the show notes. Dr. Dupont is a professor of criminology at the University of Montreal, the Canada Research Chair in Cybersecurity, the Research Chair for the Prevention of Cybercrime, and the Scientific Director of the Smart Cybersecurity Network. As some of you might suspect, I have had regular occasions to chat with Dr. Dupont, but you might be surprised to hear that we very rarely talk about his research. So I took advantage of the opportunity from having him on the show to let him know that I sort of think of him as a crime futurist.
I wouldn't say maybe crime futurist, but maybe more security futurist. So the common good of security, you know, how is it being adapted to changes in crime, changes in technology, changes in how society is being organized. I'm not a pure criminologist in the sense that my PhD and my original work is in political science and more influenced by the changes in institutions and the way that societies organize themselves. And I think you're right about the futurist part. It's about trying to understand the adaptation processes of societies and their political and social institutions. So crime being the vector of those changes. So that's why I get, you know, really excited to learn more about discovering how cyber criminals or criminals adopt and leverage technologies to extend, you know, their criminal profits and their reach. But it's not because I'm so much interested in the future of crime as in the future of crime as being a trigger for changes in society and trying to understand the patterns it follows so that we can maybe think about how institutions and policing, not the police, but policing in the broad sense.
20 years ago, you looked at police work and technological fallacies, and you applied, was it Marx and Corbett's 8 techno fallacies to police work? And one of those is there's no such thing as a free lunch. So the pertinent question here is, if we have to pay for lunch, where in Montreal should we go for lunch?
So I think in Montreal, well, if you get me started on that, it will change from a criminology podcast into a restaurant, a restaurateur or a gastronomy podcast. But I would advise when things reopen that we all go to Milos together, which is it's a Greek restaurant. It has the freshest fish and the freshest produce. The tomatoes are never refrigerated to remain fresh. So I don't know if you living in Canada, I don't know if people listening to the podcast grasp what it means to eat tomatoes that were never refrigerated in the heart of winter. But what's even more interesting is that the owner of this restaurant is a Greek guy, and he ships a lot of his stuff directly from Greece, where his family still lives. And actually he came to Canada, or actually initially came to the US and then moved to Canada because he came to North America to study criminology. I think he arrived in the 70s or early 80s. And what he found in terms of the restaurant scene wasn't really what he thought who he deserved. So he actually branched from criminology to the restaurant industry, and he provided us with this fantastic restaurant. And actually he has outposts in New York City, London, Dubai, and a couple of other places. And this is really a fantastic restaurant. And at lunch every day, you get a 3-course meal for $24, which is probably what you pay for a single main of fish that you order in the evening. So it's the best deal in town and the best fish in town.
There's another career path out of a criminology degree.
Exactly.
Put that one in the brochure. One of the other fallacies were it was novelty, and another one was fail-safe system. So let's go from food markets to online crime markets. The fact that they get caught suggests that the fail-safe fallacy is that. What's new about online crime markets and what isn't new?
I think what's new, which isn't so new, but is actually enabled by technology, is the scale at which criminal projects can now be deployed by offenders, cyber offenders. Fraud used to be conducted at a very local level and needed, as it does now, a range of expertise that was probably more difficult for offenders to assemble locally. And now what cybercrime platforms enable, whether on the darknet or on the open web, is that they bring together people who can work together on projects from very different places in the world, and they can assemble very quickly. And it's not so different from the other freelancer platforms that you find on the internet, or the way startups sometimes just begin with people based in different cities around the world and having an interesting idea that they're trying to pursue remotely. But for crime, this is something that is maybe more surprising or a little bit newer, in a sense that there is this trust element in business, in entrepreneurship. You know, trust is something that is probably much easier to establish because you have contracts. In crime, you cannot have the types of contracts, legal protections. So the trust element is really paramount. And the local dimension of crime enabled word of mouth, for example, and reputations to precede people and to kind of let others know, okay, this person is really reliable. Let's bring her or bring him in. And this person is just going to fail or is just not that good. And let's try to avoid him or avoid her. And what those cybercrime platforms are enabling is really something at scale. And of course, that the other side of the coin is that you can reach a massive number of victims as well, because the digital ecosystem is a global ecosystem. So you can reach hundreds of thousands of potential victims where in the past you needed to kind of have this physical interaction somehow that was limiting in some sense. So I think that's what has changed. The underlying mechanics of trying to manipulate people is not so different. But the scale and the speed and the innovation, I think, are really different. I don't want to overdo it because there are probably more. It's more an evolution than a revolution. The adaptation is not as fast as we imagine, and not, as you mentioned, as you implied, not as effective. And there are lots of fails, like startups. You know, lots of cyber criminals get caught and get arrested. The serious ones, and there are also lots of them who have very little hope of making a profit out there because they just don't have the skills and the grits and the determination to really perform well.
They need that X factor to be the elite of the elite.
You need to be an entrepreneur.
That trust element is something that's very interesting because, as you point out in the paper, traditionally with physical crime, you might have an enforcer or some kind of physical punishment as an incentive to keep with your verbal contract. That can't really happen online.
It's a very good question that I'm afraid won't have a very clear answer. So I'm going to try to be as as clear as I can be in my own mind and try to convey that. But so first, in terms of the violence as a regulatory mechanism in more conventional forms of crime, we should first understand, you know, violence is very rarely used even by the Italian mob. And it's not that important. It's the threat of violence. It's the possibility of being the victim of physical harm if you don't abide by your side of the deal, that is really important. It's either harm to you or to your family or to your business. So this is a very strong regulatory mechanism that doesn't get to be exercised very often, but that's very powerful. Online, as you mentioned, it almost vanishes. I say almost because there are still threats that can be made against you. There are practices such as doxing. So that's disclosing your real name and your real address and information about you and your family, or swatting. So there are ways to leverage some forms of threats or violence against you that actually can make people think twice about whether you're going to cross your co-offenders. But it's really peripheral. It's most of the people never go to such extremes in those types of markets. And so it comes down to trust and to reputation. And the answer has been to, so in the past, reputation was forged by interpersonal relationships. And that's why local crime was to a certain extent easier to carry out, because you either knew people because you grew up together in the same ethnocultural group, immigrant group. You went to the same schools. You belonged to the same sports club. So you practiced soccer. You practiced boxing, where you met people who belonged to this kind of criminal underground. You went to jail together, so you spent months and sometimes years together. So you had time to study, to build an identity that everyone who cared to learn more about you could uncover by word of mouth. Online, you're hiding behind avatars and pseudonyms, so no one really knows who you really are and where you come from. And it's really hard to assess your reliability from just the name that you're using as a nickname and the picture you're using as an avatar and the way you talk and you write and you type. So the answer has been borrowed from legal licit markets like eBay and Amazon, and using a reputation system where all the people who have done business with you can leave a comment and they can give you a rating. And if you're interested in working with a new co-offender, you can go on your platform of choice and you can pull out the profile of your potential accomplice and you can find out what others are saying about that person, whether they've been reliable, unreliable, whether they deliver on time, whether they provide you bonus goods and services, and so on and so forth. So this is what has been adopted to criminal markets. And what we found in the prior paper is that actually those systems put in place by the administrators are not very effective, because the participants to these markets actually take it not so seriously and inject a lot of banter and sarcasm and counterproductive comments that actually make those reputation scores very unreliable. And I think I remember more than a third of those comments are actually nonsensical, in the sense that what they state is actually the exact opposite of what they mean. So of course, humans can still detect sarcasm, but it means that the whole purpose of those reputation systems are undermined by the very people who should be benefiting from them. And so we tied that to the tricksterism that is very prevalent in the hacker culture that my colleague Gabriella Coleman from McGill highlighted when she studied Anonymous. The hacker as trickster, someone who's very reluctant to engage, even if it's for their own benefit, in those kind of market mechanisms, because they want to remain free, they want to not be rated or assessed by others. They want to remain individuals.
A lot of that earlier work was with open markets.
Yeah.
Websites that are like forums that anyone can sort of get onto and you can review the content. It's a place to learn, but a fairly public platform. Alternative to that is a more elite type of market, which is a closed market, which you have to be vetted to be able to get into. You can't just go onto the internet and read these markets. You need an ID, a password, and to get that, you need to be vetted by someone. So it's more of a closed community. And obviously, these are hard to research. But for this paper, you had a bit of a break.
So the limitations we have as criminologists, because of the ethics approvals we must get as well, is that we are very often limited to those, as you mentioned, open criminal markets, which very often are entry-level cybercrime forums for beginner or aspiring cybercriminals with very limited skill sets, and where actually what's happening is very low level, and it's very easy to access, but the downside it's not very useful to understand the hardcore group of cyber criminals doing the real damage. So we had a break, as you mentioned, because of this hack by a French white hat hacker who actually had been studying dark code. And dark code was created in early 2000s by more experienced and more skilled hackers who wanted to have a smaller community of people technically adept and building their own malware, actually, without the interference of beginners asking them all kinds of silly questions and trying to interfere with their dealings. So it was created in that mindset. And as you mentioned, it's really hard to infiltrate. It's not impossible, and lots of security people have managed to do it, but we're limited in academia because of the ethics guidelines. But you had to be invited to be a member of that market. You had to be actually to introduce yourself, to provide a CV almost of what you were able to do, and you were voted by the existing members of that market. So it was like a hiring process. And what happened is that Xylitol managed to infiltrate that market. He actually lurked around for a number of months, and then he kind of leaked all the database because he wanted to show actually what was happening inside that market. And he leaked publicly a database of screen captures of every single conversation inside that community. And he leaked privately to law enforcement organizations the content of the database of exchanges. So we had access not to the private leak of the database, but the public leak of screen captures. So I think we had more than 4,500 screen captures of extended conversations in JPEG format for those of your listeners who are technically adept. And so what we did, we hired for a couple of summers students who had to read through the content of the conversations, because we explored the possibility with computer science colleagues to do automated character recognition to automate the transcription of the conversations, but it was just impossible, and I'll spare you the details. But so we read all the conversations and we coded the conversations. And what interested us most, and they were public conversations, so we didn't have access to the private exchanges between the members of that market. But since it was already an exclusive invitation-only market for us, even those public exchanges were very, very useful, because it was a group of the 400 most expert criminal hackers in the world. So it was a breakthrough. And what we did, we tried to understand and to code qualitatively, and it was a qualitative research, very different from the research done in other by other groups in computer science. So it's very complementary. So we tried to understand how someone was admitted into this market first. And then the second paper, the paper we're talking about, was about, okay, how does this market, where everyone has been selected by friends or people who know them already and have established their reliability, how does it handle conflicts between members?
The forum did have some rules around making complaints, as forum administrators pointed out by posting,
"If someone took your money and never finished his part of the deal, never replies, and is obviously f***ing you, feel free to post. But only if you can prove it. If you would prefer to take the matter up in private, feel free to PM to mod or admin."
Who was it that would generally complain? Who took advantage of this structure of posting about bad business dealers?
What was surprising to us is the complaints were coming from a very concentrated group of people, usually new members of the forum. So the forum was organized hierarchically. There were different levels of membership, and the more experienced you were and the longer you had been a member of that forum, and the higher you were in terms of the multi-level structure of that forum. And most of the complaints were coming from people at the bottom of this hierarchy. So the 2/3 of the complaints were coming from people who were called fresh fish or guests. So their applications were being processed by the members of the forum, and they were granted temporary access to the main platform where they could access sellers of services and goods. So 2/3 of the complainants were new members, and 90% of accusations were against those new members or people who didn't belong to the forum, but were active on other forums. And this forum served as a way for people to complain and to warn members of Dark Code against those unreliable dealers.
There was a couple of different things that they would complain about. And one of them was sort of a bad transaction. For example,
hello, I am writing here this detailed information about Hadesbot and its functions, that this bot is not what they say in the sales thread. The reality of this bot is, it's a non-working beta version.
What were the majority of complaints about?
Almost 60% of the complaints were against sellers, and a tiny minority, like I think a little bit more than 7% against buyers. So it's buyers complaining against sellers of goods and services. So the typical complaint was, okay, I purchased a customized piece of malware from that person, and I sent that person the money. And what they deliver wasn't at all what I expected. So they delivered nothing. They delivered only something that's not operational, that keeps on breaking down. They delivered something that I ended up finding out was free somewhere else. They didn't deliver they didn't provide the level of service I was expecting. So when I have a question, that person takes forever to answer me. Sometimes that person promised me something by the end of next week, and it's been 3 months since I've been kind of trying to reconnect with that person, and it never came through. So it's a variety of really customer service problems and the terms of delivery.
You mentioned that sometimes they sort of make complaints against particular individuals, such as when one member posted,
first, you seemed nice person to me, with a sense of humor, but now I see why you get banned on every forum.
The remaining 30% of complaints is warning people against the claims of others. So people who say that they're very good coders or that they have access to so many thousands of bots, and in the end, you know, it's not the reality. So people are saying on those forums, okay, well, don't trust that person because what they're saying is completely bogus, and they're just trying to scam you. And it's a warning not to do business with that, with a certain person or a certain group. But those warnings are more like general warnings against entering into a business relationship. The previous complaints I talked about against sellers, it's usually about a specific transaction.
So overall, what's the kind of impact here? Are they getting ripped off and going out of business, losing thousands and thousands of dollars to scammers on their own forums, or is it something relatively minor that they can incorporate into the cost of doing criminal business?
To me, that was the most important insights from this data set. We assume that cyber criminals, because of the scale I mentioned a bit earlier, are those super rich and super wealthy criminals, and that they're making millions of dollars very easily and are getting rich very, very quick. And the cybersecurity companies actually contribute to that mythology of people earning tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. So in those complaints that we analyzed, to be taken seriously, you have to state the harm that you've suffered, the financial harm. So actually, people say, well, I've been defrauded by so many hundreds or thousands of dollars. I'm being owed that money. And to me, it's a proxy of actually the size of the transactions and the size of the money exchanges between those cyber criminals So it's not a representative sample, but I take it that these numbers actually reflect, I would say, pretty accurately, you know, some of the, you know, average sizes of criminal contracts being concluded between people. And what I was very surprised to find was that actually the amounts are really, really small, considering, you know, to remind you, this is a group of the top 500 criminal hackers, English-speaking criminal hackers in the world. Well, the average loss for those conflicts was a little bit more than $1,000, and the median loss was $300. So this is not the kind of transactions between people making millions of dollars or people buying malware for hundreds of thousands of dollars or buying zero-day exploits, you know, like the intelligence agencies do for millions of dollars. These are very small transactions between people for whom, you know, $300 actually is a big deal. When you read the complaints, you know, it's not, they're not doing this, you know, for a matter of principle. For them, it's a real loss, and they want to be compensated for that. And maybe we're hyping up a little bit the profits some of those people are earning, and maybe we need to be a little bit more realistic about their gains. So the range was like the largest loss was a little bit less than $20,000. For a cryptocurrency account hack, of which the profits were not shared fairly between the parties involved. So there was a complaint for that amount of money. But the smallest complaint was for $20. So if you're an elite hacker and you complain for a $20 loss, you know, I would invite people to reconsider the kind of money they're making, you know. And actually, it was very apparent in the comments, people, because what was very interesting, you could see what people were saying about those complaints. So some people said, well, you know, guys, this is the cost of doing business. You have to absorb those losses. And then you can understand a bit better why those complaints mainly involve new members of this forum. Maybe they're less established and they're not making as much money as the top brass in this forum, and the top brass probably doesn't get involved in those very unreliable transactions or very uncertain transactions or very kind of unsatisfactory deals. But it was a real surprise for us. I expected to find losses of tens of thousands of dollars. You know, if those people are making millions every year, you know, you take the time to complain for something that's significant, not $20.
What's the outcome of these complaints generally? Is there a real enforcement aspect that's reliable? Or you make a complaint, you sully the online avatar of a bad dealer, and then everyone continues with their day?
Pretty much the second option. Almost 3/4 of the complaints had no clear outcomes. So no decision taken, even by the administrators. Sometimes the complaint veered off in an entirely different direction. We found, again, like what we found in the more open forums, this high level of volatility between members. So people, and you have to remember, they're mostly young males, you know, very impulsive. And very often the conversation starts about a complaint against someone. And then people, for no apparent reason, start on insulting each other's or questioning each other's integrity. And then it becomes an ego fight. And the initial objective of the complaint is entirely lost on all the participants. It becomes something entirely different. So the settlement rate for those complaints is a little bit more than 25, actually a little bit less than 25%, and mostly bans. So people are being excluded from the forum. People are being asked to pay back the money when they accept the settlement. And a tiny fraction of the people are suspended temporarily, so for maybe a couple of weeks or a month or so, which harms their capacity to conduct business. What's interesting as well is that some people who are complained against are also the complainants against others. And you can be complained against both as a seller and as a buyer. So it's interesting to see that some people are consistently unreliable, whether they buy or they sell, and that you can also conduct business on this forum for a year or two without any single complaint, and suddenly a deal just explodes in your face and you're being called out, although you've been very consistent for 1 or 2 years. So we see that those forums, even the ones where you've been picked and vetted, still remain very unstable, and that's probably, you know, the cost of doing business with those kind of people, both as an age group and as a self-select group of scammers.
If we assume that the goal of establishing Darkcode was to keep out the riffraff and to make a place where people could concentrate on doing business without being bothered, and establish a more productive forum for criminal enterprise, do you think it was successful?
Probably not as successful as its promoters expected it to be, but probably successful to a certain extent, in the sense that it limited the number of people who were able to actually, you know, introduce this level of unreliability or level of defections in the transactions. And also probably one of the reasons why we don't find the higher level members is because they kind of conducted their business in private. And so having those complaints being lodged publicly maybe helped them avoid dealing with those low-level, unreliable members. And with Jonathan Lusthaus, with whom I co-authored this paper, we tried to also remind the readers that many other dispute resolution mechanisms in the legal world are not much more effective than this one. So just the fact that it existed and it was set up probably was an improvement on things. Certainly not as helpful and as useful as expected, but probably to a certain extent reached some of its objectives. But to know that for sure, we need to be able to interview the high-level users of that forum.
So I guess that brings me to the question of where does this kind of research go? Is that the direction? Is it interviewing those high-level people? Where's the interesting future for research into these criminal forums?
The future would be to try to map the migration, because as those forums are taken down by law enforcement, you know, only a small fraction of their members are arrested. So others move on to other settings, convergence settings. So we need I think to be able to understand how people move from one forum to another, and how new forums and new venues, new platforms replace the ones that have been taken down, and how those members who are not arrested make a decision to move to a specific forum instead of another one. So I think we need to reintroduce this kind of human element, this decision making. I mean, there is only so much we can infer from just analyzing posts that have been made in the past. We need to be able to reach out and to access those members who haven't been arrested. And I know some of my colleagues are trying to do that. It's excessively difficult because you need to establish trust yourself, and the respondents need to be satisfied that you're not going to give away some of their contact details to law enforcement, and you're not going to betray the trust they place in you. And probably trying to understand as well how the more private tools, such as the, you know, messaging apps, are being used by the members of this community. And I think the other side of, you know, interesting future research could be trying to really understand the economics of criminal profits, cybercrime profits, because for now, and my colleague Mike Maguire is trying to do that, and others are trying to better capture how much money they're really making, and who's making how much money, and what are the skills of those people who are successful and not arrested. And again, you know, it's a mixture of trying to interview them and also trying to look at the numbers. And very often we get stuck at the stage where we take for granted the prices that we find advertised on the darknet or on dark markets. And what we fail to consider is that very often the prices advertised are just the first step in a very, sometimes very long negotiations. We need to understand not what people advertise some specific tools and services for, but what buyers end up really paying for them. And that's something that we haven't really still fully grasped in criminology or cybercrime or cybersecurity research.
Thank you for your time. It was great talking with you, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, and I'll keep on rambling on this subject.
Thank you again to Dr. Dupont for sharing his insights and shining the light of reality on a subject that is generally pretty shadowy. His comments about moving past the fiction and looking to find the reality about these dark illicit markets got me thinking about that iceberg diagram. You know, the one that looks great in any presentation about darknets? Icebergs don't look like that. It's just not how things float. I invite you to pop over to joshdata.me/iceberger.html to have a play with an iceberg simulator to see how they really float. Now, while such illustrations and metaphors can be helpful when we communicate to others, we ourselves do have to be careful with these fictions, lest we forget to question them. This has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. If you do have a question or a comment about the show, you can reach me at cybercrimeology on Twitter or by old-fashioned email at cybercrimeology@gmail.com.